sure that this is working.
Well, it's not a correction so much as a matter of emphasis sometimes, but the
I have one person now who's had his transcript for a while, and he said, it's not the content. He said, I don't like the way it sounds. Well, I think everything is working all right here. So let me get started, as I know you have other commitments, and I appreciate your taking the time this morning.
That's okay.
Let's begin by indicating today is January 27th, 1995. This is Jim Boning speaking with Dexter Baker at his home in Naples, although we're not really in Naples.
Yes, we are.
Are we?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, this is Naples' address.
Okay.
But we're right on the border. We're in northern Collier County here.
Okay. I know that you were born in Worcester, Mass. On April 16th, 1927.
Right.
Could you tell me a little bit about your parents and your family background?
Well, my father was an engineer and was with a kind of a wire goods company and manufactured a variety of wire products from hardware to kitchenware. He was a graduate engineer. But had gone into sales. In this case, it was a kind of consumer product sales. We moved from Massachusetts to Worcester when I was seven in 1933, I guess, and to suburban Philadelphia, and the Philadelphia Mid-Atlantic area became his territory for this Worcester-based company.
Depression have any effect on that?
Well, you know, I didn't observe too much. I mean, we had a pleasant home in the suburbs of Philadelphia. My father, I don't think, ever made a lot of money. My father and mother were divorced certainly after we got to Philadelphia. And so my father raised me and my younger brother and did his travelings, and he subsequently did marry again, but it was, you know, many, many years after the divorce. My mother was, you know, was a caring mother when she was in the home, but she found somebody else, I guess, to her liking, and left our home when we were relatively young. I was seven, and my brother was five. And so we grew up in suburban Philadelphia. I went to Upper Darby High, played basketball, was in the band, tried out for baseball, but I wasn't good on grounders, so I stuck to basketball. Enjoyed music as well. Played. I sang in the glee club.
And he
was keen on becoming an engineer, actually, because my father had been an engineer.
Okay.
He graduated in electrical engineering from Harvard back in I guess 22, and so that was his class year. And so, because he was interested in engineering and selling, that was kind of an area that I got interested in. And I, of course, wanted to build things and sell things. When I graduated from high school in 1945, the war, World War II, was still on, and I was drafted into the Navy. And went through basic training. Ultimately, got assigned as a seaman to the War College up in Newport, Rhode Island. I said, well, if I'm going to be in the Navy, I might as well be an officer. So I applied for a fleet appointment to the Naval Academy, and I was accepted to go to the Navy's prep school for the Naval Academy. and was transferred to Williamsburg, Virginia, which is at their Camp Perry school there. And that was a nice assignment because Williams and Marriott College was there, and during the war there weren't many men around, so the Navy boys were much in demand. Although we studied very hard, we didn't have a lot of spare time. But Williamsburg is a nice place, and this took us until the spring of '46, and then the Naval Academy prep program kind of dried up because World War II was now over. Japan had surrendered and the decks of the Missouri, and they really weren't looking for future admirals in any great demand. And so they offered me an opportunity to get an early discharge. And since the summer was coming along, when the Navy offers you something, you don't, you know, always argue. So I took the discharge, and it ended up that I had 11 months and 13 days of active service. And I said, well, you know, maybe that 1 year is going to give me a benefit that I won't get, but I'll make that up by working this summer. And I had been accepted to Lehigh University as a incoming freshman, and so I said, well, I'll go ahead and take the appointment, work this summer, and be ready to go in the fall. So I did that, and started out as a civil engineer at Lehigh, and then switched to mechanical engineering because I was more interested in machinery than I was in structures, and developed an interest in turbines, which was the big mechanical items that were hot, and gas turbines were just being developed as a result of the jet engine work in World War II, and they were just beginning to look for commercial applications for those. I took a job with Alice Chalmers after I graduated from Lehigh in 1950, and of course the summer of 50 the Korean War broke out, and when the North invaded the South, and I'd been at Alice Chalmers about 4 months, so working on gas turbines and steam turbines, when Uncle Sam invited me to come back and join the Army this time. and so I was really a very popular draftee, and so because I was within a qualifying age and because I did not have 12 months of active service, I was invited to join the Army for 2 years. And went through Fort Belvoir, became a Corps of Engineer, PFC, but was able to arrange an appointment to the Engineering Research and Development Laboratories because they were in great demand for engineers, and the fact that I was PFC didn't make any difference. I was a graduate engineer, and you know they had to pay $600 a month for a graduate from college, but they could get me for $75 a month as a PFC. I had married Dottie, who I'd met in my senior year at Lehigh, and she was working for my commanding officer as a secretary, and I was working as an engineer in the engine branch, developing high-speed, small-size gas turbine engines for power sources for the military, driving pumps and generators, and to try to, you know, reduce the weight of these big diesel engines that they had to lug around. And it was interesting that one of the applications for those gas turbines that which were being developed at the research laboratories of the Army was to drive air compressors for oxygen plants. And the oxygen plant division next door to our engine branch was a customer of the engines that we were trying to develop. So I got to know a little bit about oxygen plants, and so had that in the back of my mind. I spent the 2 years there at Fort Belvoir, and as a PFC. The military finally developed some special job classifications, MOSs, that qualify by all of these engineers that they had recruited into the Army, so that we were not classified as tank mechanics, but as, you know, graduate engineers. And so I did that for, three quarters of the time that I was in the Army. And
could I back up for a moment?
Sure.
Just to go back to Lehigh a little bit.
Yeah, right.
A little bit more about the Lehigh engineering
program.
Curriculum and what it was like when you were there in the late
40s. Well, it was a good program. Lehigh, like many other schools, was very, very busy in 1946 because they had to accept all of the admissions of people they had offered to who were regularly coming through from the 1946 graduate. And then they had all of these offers that they had outstanding during the war, and so the campus was crowded. I had a lab mate who was like 40 years old, married, two children, and because we had a great diversity, and of course they were the largest classes. But it was a good time, and the spirits were good. It was the first class really after the war, so to speak, and so that all the programs were back in place. I had great professors in thermodynamics and machine design, and I didn't have time for music. I played college basketball for 1 year. I joined a fraternity and developed good relationships with there. Lehigh was an all-male school, however.
That's right. That's right.
As were many prominent men's schools, and they, along with others, stayed kind of a single-sex school until in the late 50s when they changed, and now of course they're full co-ed like most schools are. So we didn't have a lot of distractions on campus. We had two great parties a year where we could invite the girlfriends to come and spend the week with us. We didn't have any co-ed dorms or any of those kind of fun things that exist today. But Lehigh was, I thought, good for me. It was not a large school, so you could develop good relationships with your professors, good relationships with your classmates. You tended to know everybody. You tended to interact with everybody in your class. Our graduating class at Lehigh at that time was probably around 600 today, and now they were all men. Today it's over 1,000. So you develop good loyalties, good relationships that have really lasted throughout my life, and so I had a very pleasant experience there.
Was there any particular reason you selected Lehigh over Drexel?
A good friend of my father's was Ed Blackmar, and who had been an outstanding wrestler. And Lehigh had one of the nationally ranked wrestling teams under Billy Sheridan, the Scotsman, who had started the program there. And so Ed was a proud Lehigh graduate, and he was a colleague of my father. And he said, "Well, look, in looking around, make sure you go up to Lehigh." Well, when we went out there, we liked the campus, we liked the environment, we liked the size, and we took kind of Ed's word, and quite frankly, I didn't apply anyplace else. Mm-hmm. When they accepted me, straight out in 1945, before I went in the service the first time, I just kind of said, "Well, that's fine," but it wasn't a decision I had to make at that time, and so I had 12 months to think about it, as it turned out. And having decided not to go to Annapolis, Lehigh was good. It was relatively near my home in Philadelphia. It was in downtown Bethlehem area. I went in the service, and then in 1952, my 2 years in Fort Belvoir were up, and so I had to start looking for a job. And I had kind of decided that I didn't want to go back to Alice Chalmers. Alice Chalmers had gone through a big strike when the communist trade unions took over, and their relative position in the business relative to Westinghouse and GE And so I set up.
How did you hook up with them in the first place?
Well, in 1946, 1950, we were really the first postgraduate war class that was graduating, and there really weren't that many jobs around. And I interviewed, and Alice Chalmers offered me a job that would be in gas turbine engines. And so I took it, and I wanted to kind of go away from Pennsylvania area just to see other parts of the country. And so Wisconsin looked to be a nice place, Milwaukee. And had I maybe hung around, maybe I would have taken a job with Westinghouse at GE, but the people there, and they offered a good offer. And I was one of the first to get a job offer, so I felt pretty good about that. And it turned out that my wife, Dottie, she wasn't my wife at the time, and I didn't even know her, but she was running the placement office. And so she kind of met me there and kind of pushed my resume, I guess, a little bit. And at least she knew what a resume was. And I think, the war experience, I was a little bit more mature than the average graduate. I'd been in the Navy. I'd been in the Naval Academy prep program, and so I was a little bit older, maybe a little bit more experienced, and I guess I had expressed an interest in sales and marketing, and they were looking for somebody with that kind of a background. And so after November of 1952, now we're married. We have our first daughter, first of four. Mm-hmm. We were earning, I guess we'd gotten up to $90 a month from 75, and so we went back to Dottie's home, which was outside of Bethlehem, and started looking for the new jobs. And so we sent out resumes to Lycoming Engine, who were building gas turbine engines, and to Allison and Westinghouse and GE, and still thinking that, the big thing was going to be gas turbines, and if you're a mechanical engineer, you ought to get involved in that. And I got offers from most of those, but Westinghouse was in the Philadelphia area. Leicester, Pennsylvania, down along the river near the Philadelphia airport. And so I'd gotten a good offer, as I recall, $465 a month or something like that. And I was only making $300 when I was at Alice Chalmers, so I thought that was pretty nice. And only making $90 in the Army. And we went down there to look for the... for a job, and to look at the job. And Leicester, Pennsylvania is not a very pleasant, it's along the river, and there's a lot of old buildings, and we couldn't find any decent apartments in the area. And I'm sure if we kept looking and gone a little bit further, we would have found something. We didn't have a lot of money, so it had to be a rental place. And so I was kind of discouraged about it, and so I was thumbing through mechanical engineering, and the back of the magazine was a little tiny ad for a sales engineer for oxygen plants in a company called Air Products and Chemicals in Emmaus, Pennsylvania. And that was the Lehigh Valley. And, I liked the Lehigh Valley. Dottie's family there, we had a little child. They liked the grandchildren, grandchild at that time. And... So, since Dottie had been the assistant director of placement at Lehigh University, I went over to Lehigh and talked to Everett Teal, the placement director, and I said, "What can you tell me about this firm, Air Products, over in Emmaus, Pennsylvania?" And he said, "Oh, they're a terrible company." he said they'll get a contract, they'll hire engineers, they'll lose the contract, or they'll finish the contract, and let the engineers go, they're hiring and firing. And I said, "Well, what should I do? I mean, there's an ad here." He said, take the job with Westinghouse. Take the job. Now, Everett was a was used to be wined and dined by the recruiters from the big companies, so he was somewhat, you know, partial. And so and Dottie kind of explained that. I said, well, look, they're offering me a sales engineer right away. If I go to Westinghouse, I have to start out on the drawing board, and I'd really rather get out and sell and market and, you know, help bring customers and suppliers together. So I went over there, and the first person I met was Ed Donnelly. And he was had just been made sales manager, and he was probably in his 30s at the time, and I was 24 maybe. And he'd been sales manager for the equipment sales, for the selling of the plant, not the gases, but selling the plant to the government and to the private sector. And they'd just gotten a couple of big orders, and they had several prospects, and they were looking for an additional sales engineer because he'd moved up, and now they had to fill that position. And so I was impressed with Ed. I took a whole battery of sales engineering aptitude tests, and I guess I scored very well on those tests. And they invited me back for a follow-up interview. And the personnel officer, Mrs. Reinmiller, said, you had the best scores of anybody we've ever had in here. Well, Ed was called out of town on the second interview. And so I was asked to meet a Frank Pavlis. Now, Frank was the first employee of the company that Leonard Poole, who founded the company, had hired. I think Frank had the first nickel that he'd ever owned, and he still had it. And he was a very frugal guy. And Air Products had to be frugal, because, I mean, they were totally dependent upon the government. They were still privately, well, at this time they were publicly owned, but they were privately owned all through the war. And, of course, they lost everything after the war. I think even Ed had to take a layoff and then came back and was in the company in 52 when I was interviewing there. Well, anyway, Pavlis interviewed me, and, you know, he tried to kind of negotiate me down. He said, well, we can't pay what Westinghouse is going to pay, and, you know, you don't have any experience in oxygen plants. And but he says, look, he said, if you live with your in-laws, you can save all the rent money and you can afford to come to work for Air Products for $75 a month. Well, I guess it was $100 a month less at that time. I said, well, gee whiz, I've gone through the war, I spent 2 years, and here now I'm starting out, you know, essentially the same place where I was 2 years ago. And but Ed had impressed me, and the growth plans had impressed me. The company only had 200 people. We were $2.5 million in sales. I mean, and I was young, and so it was all upside. Was, you know, Westinghouse was structured and organized, and you know, everything had to be done by the numbers. So there wasn't that kind of easy entrepreneurial gung-ho spirit, which is such an attractive thing, I think, for a company. And you know, the freedom to act and the freedom to, you know, test yourself and your ideas and your concepts and so forth. So anyway, based more on Donnelly's selling skills, but Frank's idea of taking a pay cut, I went to the Dottie's folks and said, well, what do you think about it? Well, they'd love to have us in the air and like the grandchild, and sure, we'll put you up for a while. And I'm expecting a call from Mark McKean. I'm out of business and interview you at the same time. So I accepted the deal with my in-laws and Air Products and started there in the fall of 52. Had sales of, as I said, about $2.5 million in that year. And I have spent the last 40 years there. One of the things I kid people about, I said that Pavlos negotiated such a tough deal that I've been really making it up ever since. One of the interesting things in those aptitude tests that they described was they said, well, what would you like to do at Air Products? What would your career ambitions be? And they had like seven lines on the chart and on a page. So I said, oh, well, I'd like to be a sales engineer, I'd like to become a sales manager, and I'd like to become vice president of sales, and then a general manager, and then an executive vice president, and then president, and the chairman of the board. And I filled out all the seven lines. And that's precisely
really
what I did with my career. And so when young recruits come to Air Products, either right out of college or summer interns, I tell the story. And I say, now remember, when you fill out an application form for Air Products, make sure you fill up all the lines. So. But it does make a point, I think that you can do anything you want to do. You know, assuming that the opportunities exist, the climate exists, and so if you want to become chairman and you do all of the things that if necessary, there's a possibility that you can be chairman and CEO of a company someday. And but you just have to set goals and you have to set targets for yourself, and then do all the things that are necessary. But I think so many people never set those goals. And the goals don't have to be expansive. They don't have to be complicated. When I went to England after I'd been with the company, the Scott Air Products in Europe, I put a strategic plan on one side of one piece of paper. I wanted 25% of the UK market, and I wanted 10% of the continental European market, and I wanted to do that within 10 years. When I came CEO of Air Products, I wrote the annual report for the year 1996, and we were then $2 billion in sales. And I said, by 1996, we're going to be $6 billion in sales. We're going to have earnings of $5 a share. We're going to have 50% of our sales outside the United States. We're going to have an environmental business. We're going to have a chemical business. We're going to have a gas business. We're going to be the leading industrial gas company in the world. Well, we are well on that goal. And partly, I think, as a compliment to myself, but the CEO who gave the speech at the annual meeting yesterday, Hap Wagner, my successor, says, we are right on our plan. And so it says that you can, if you set stretching goals, become better than you otherwise would without the goal. If you just respond to events rather than drive yourself towards lofty goals and then share those goals and get buy-in to those goals by everybody in the organization, people really like to respond to clearly defined challenges. And not so precise and so restrictive that they don't have room to maneuver in operating. The great thing about my relationships with Ed Donnelly, and I don't know whether it was deliberate or it was just his style, but he gave me the latitude to develop the business as I thought it could be developed. And he would provide guidance and act as a you know, a referral source and somebody that you could bounce ideas off of with, but you know, you set the goals, you set the targets, you organize, and as long as you achieve those things. Now, your goals can be unrealistic, so that nobody will buy into them because they don't believe in it. But I tell you, when we said we're going to be 3 times our size in 10 years, there are a lot of skeptics at Air Products too. But everybody has to feel that they're part of something that potentially can become bigger and better, and that they will be rewarded as a consequence. I mean, it's the driving forces that cause people to excel. So I filled out that application form and I hit every target, and it took me 40 years to do it. So it's just been a wonderful, wonderful experience.
Did you meet Leonard Poole before you signed on?
I met him just briefly in the hall, and his brother George, and you know, we were in a building smaller than this house. This is a 7,000 square foot house, so I don't think our office was that big. And we had a dirt floor factory out in the back. I met him, and you know, you're a young PFC out of the Army, and here's a guy that founded the company. He was a strong, clear focus, clear thinking, futures oriented kind of a guy, and I'm a young potential sales engineer, so it's hard to make quick impressions, but everybody has spoke well of Leonard, of his entrepreneurial spirit and his drive. But I think it was Ed who influenced me the most. I mean, Pavlis will take credit for hiring me, and there's a guy going to hit a ball right out of the water. I want to see how much he gets splashed. I don't know why he didn't pick it up. Oh, he did pick it up. Ed was really my mentor for the first 5 years until I was asked to go to Europe. I became head of the sales of auction plants of the chemical industry. That was the area that I carved out as my niche. And then we had another sales manager who looked after government, somebody else looked after the steel industry, and those were the three major markets. And then we had a kind of an export business that was a fourth area. I operated in the export business to start with because it was the small package plants. And then the chemical industry started showing interest in air separation plants for a variety of ammonia plants and applications. And then I succeeded Ed as sales manager for all of the process equipment when he became general manager of the process. And then he had engineering and purchasing and design and manufacturing all reporting to him, and then I had the sales function. And I was still only maybe 29 years old.
It's a lot of responsibility for.
I didn't. I didn't think about it as it just. It was a job that had to be done. It was fun doing it. There were lots of opportunities. We were building, relationships. We were very, very small. By any rights, we should never have existed. I mean, Union Carbide ignored us to their cars. But, I mean, they were king of the hill. I mean, they were 100 times our size. And they were the leader in this field. Just as Linde was the leader in Germany, and British Oxygen the leader in Britain, and Leroy the leader in France, and Union Carbide, and they were in a club. I mean, they didn't compete with each other. This was a cartel. And four firms dominated the world markets for industrial gases. Equipment, technology, they cross-licensed each other. It was absolutely incestuous club. and there were a few other, distributors and producers, Air Reduction, which had been the Leroy company in the United States, was a gas company. And so we would sell to other gas companies equipment, but we would have to compete with Linde and Leroy, and Messer was a French, another German company. And so I decided that because I was an engineer, I really ought to understand the business side better, and finance and marketing. And so I signed up to get my MBA school degree at Lehigh. And I couldn't go full time because I had a family and everything. But Air Products did have an education extension program. We've kept that up, and it's really worked very well. And so I took my MBA degree at night at Lehigh, and it took me about 4.5 years to do that. And one of the things that they required was a thesis on a major business project. And so I said, gee whiz, Air Products is 85% dependent on the federal government, because we were selling plants for the rocket program and package oxygen plants for the breathing and aviation, both Navy and the Air Force, and we had some business to the steel industry, but federal government, and the problem with that is, it's up and down. They want something this year, but they don't want any next year. And the company had gone through that cycle after World War II. And so I said, well, what we really ought to do is create a third leg, which is the international market. And so I did my thesis on the establishment of an international division for Air Products as a good idea. And so I did the thesis, and they were impressed with it. Got my MBA degree, and the Professor Moore, I remember him, who was in Vance Accounting, was my advisor, and he was the one that reviewed my thesis work. He said, well, I think this is so good, I'm going to send it to Leonard Poole. So Leonard Poole got this thesis, and along in about the summer of 57, when I got my degree, and I'm now 29 years old, Leonard calls me in the office with Ed Donnelly and said, I've been reading your thesis here, Dexter, and how'd you like to go to England and start Air Products in Europe? And so Leonard had the idea that we should also be international as well. And we, in fact, had licensed a small company that's been spun out of the old British coal industry, the Butterley Company, had licensed them to make packaged oxygen plants. And he said, we've been thinking about doing a joint venture and with us becoming a majority owner, and we'd like you to go over and be the managing director, and here's a one-way airplane ticket. You'll have to earn a return trip. So, you know, 29 years old, I'm Donnelly is 6 years older than I am, so he's 35. I'm not going to get around him very quickly. And so how can I continue to grow? How can I continue to develop? And, you know, taking on Union Carbide was interesting, but now here's an opportunity to take on the other three members of the cartel in Europe. And so I talked to Dottie, and Dottie's dad said, well, these opportunities only come once, you better take it. And so Dottie was keen, and Ed clearly encouraged it. And so we went abroad, and I asked Leonard, where should the office be? He said, well, you decide. And, well, I knew about Wimbledon. That was about the only place I could. I loved tennis. I was a keen tennis player. And so we decided to live in Wimbledon, and the office was initially downtown, and then finally it moved out to the suburbs near Wimbledon. Just by the time the office got built, we got transferred back to the United States. But we went there on a two-year assignment, and it took me 10 years to complete it. And so we went there from 57 to 67, and we started Air Products in Europe. And that's fun. I mean, to start a company from scratch and to take on three of the leaders in their business, in their own backyard, and to challenge them for customers. I mean, there isn't a greater challenge or opportunity that a young man can have. I mean, you know, today you'd say it was foolhardy, but we did it, you know, and we hired, you know, one person at a time, we got one customer at a time, and our licensee had screwed up two of the designs they were working on, one for the steel industry and one for the chemical, the two biggest markets, one plant that wouldn't work and the other one blew up, and so we didn't even start on the goal line, we were back of the end zone, and but you know, the integrity of the people of their products. So if we made a mistake, our licensee screwed it up, we didn't supervise them well, we're going to put it right. And Leonard and Ed and that whole team of people said, whatever it takes, whatever it costs, there's only one way of doing things, and that's the right way, and so we're going to put it right. And we did, and they worked fine. And the other thing that taught us is that when you go overseas, you've got to send your best people, because they have to operate independently from head office. There are too many decisions that have to be made on the spot, and you just have to have the confidence that the people that you're sending have what it takes to make the right decisions. To send junior people over there without the experience, And it's a hard thing for companies to do at times, because, you know, if they're really good, you need them at home to deal with the big new things you're doing at home, and to send them to a small operation overseas is inconsistent with the demands for their experience. But you'll never succeed unless you send your best, because there's just too many issues. And so I learned it. And I considered, even though I was 29, that I was probably the best marketing guy that Air Products had, and so I wasn't afraid of taking on British Oxygen and then Leverkusen and then, you know, German Messer and German Linde in their own backyards.
When you wanted to move to expand into the continent,
and I
think you bought out Butterley's then, didn't you?
Yeah, we did. I mean, we had these problems. Butterley was poor people, they didn't understand the problem, so all they were doing was signing checks, and you know, you felt sorry for them and said, well, look, here's a way to, we'll take them out. And again, we were taking the long view, mm-hmm. you know, and so they couldn't help. They were, in fact, a hindrance because we had to get their permission, and they were reluctant to put more money into something that, you know, two plants blown up, their reputation, and so if they could get some money back, but it got us started, it got us there. You know. But then,
and the other thing you had problems with arguing with Home Office was about the power aspects.
Yeah. Well, that was
European power isn't as cheap as American power.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, I wrote one really stinging letter, and then it also taught me about how to handle that. We were having a difficult time because we relied on the parent company for process engineering, a fundamental process design, not the mechanical execution that was done locally, but the flow sheet and how the flow sheet should be put together and how you balance out various economic factors. Well, the price of electricity in Europe was two or three times, because they had very high-priced coal in Europe, and we had low-cost natural gas and cheap coal. And so their electricity was hot, ours were low. So we always balanced on minimizing capital and spending more on less efficient motors and higher pressure drops and running the plants at a higher pressure. Well, when you try to sell that, the British capital charges were about the same. If anything, they had longer depreciation schedules than we did, so their capital charges were relatively low. But their power costs, their monthly annual operating costs, were high because the cost of energy was high. And so these designs that we were using were really optimized for the U.S. market, not for the European market. And so I was having some difficulty getting our customers to buy into our concept, low capital cost, and steel and chemical companies were used to optimizing on their consumables and not on their capital so much. So I complained bitterly, and then I wrote a long kind of a stinging letter to Leonard, and I said, look, you sent me over here, you said you'd support me, and you keep sending me these rubbish designs that are non-competitive, and how do you expect me to sell this rubbish if we can't be competitive? And the letter went to Leonard. He was out. I got a call from the chief process engineer one day, and he said, you know, we're working on the design, how can you help? And I said, well, look, you guys are not doing a good job. Go read my letter to Leonard. And bang. So, a couple hours later, Donnelly called me back and said, look, you're absolutely right. But what you got to do is motivate these people to help you. Don't put them on the defensive and make them feel angry at you, because they won't help you. So that was a good lesson. You know, you can vent your spleen, but if you don't motivate the other guy to do what you want, you're not accomplishing your goal. So we got that sorted out. But it was a lesson, because what it said is that you've got to design for the customer. And you've got to understand what the customer's needs are. And you've got to understand well what the competition is doing and responding to those customers' needs. And so it was the presumption that what was right in the United States was also right for Europe. You know, you had to displace that. And that helped us, because ultimately energy became more expensive in the United States too.
Need a drink yet?
No, I'm fine, thank you.
Okay. So we adjusted clearly and quickly and started putting the more capital, more heat transfer surface in, more efficient compressors, paid a little bit more in the capital, but significantly reduced our energy. And today, our designs probably are very much more optimized on what we would call a total return basis, mm-hmm. and recognizing that the customer, you know, have different ways of evaluating capital, and understanding those requirements up front is very critical to optimizing the design for that particular use or application. And in the chemical industry, for instance, they'll write the capital off over 10 years. The steel industry will write it off over 20 years. So capital charges for the steel industry are low, but operating costs is high. Chemical industry, which had been my market, you know, put relatively high capital charges on their assets because they're looking at technological obsolescence being a much higher factor, and they don't want to take 20 years to recover their capital. So in their cases, and then in most cases, the chemical industry had access to low-cost, you know, hydrocarbons, natural gas, waste heat, and so forth, so that their energy charges were normally pretty well optimized. Whereas the steel industry would quite frequently buy, you know, their power and pay, you know, high grid rates for it.
I'm quoting here from out of thin air.
Yeah.
The Home Office had not planned this expansion and at times put roadblocks in its way. Meaning you had started to open up offices.
Yeah, well, right. We wanted to go simultaneously into Germany, Belgium, Holland, France, and Italy. And we had won important contracts in those markets, again, sending one good man to that territory to develop business, respond to some of these growth people. And the interesting thing was that, you know, you think a monopoly is a tough thing to crack, but quite honestly, customers like to have choices. And so we were relatively well received. I mean, some nationalistic companies didn't want to do business with America. They only wanted to do business with the French or the Germans. But those who were generally interested in having a competitive situation welcomed us, and both in Britain and then on the continent. And we were able to win key contracts that got us established in Belgium and Germany and the Netherlands, and then into France. We acquired a joint venture relationship with Shell in France and go after that market. But because I got all of these things going simultaneously, and because some of these things took upfront capital to start a new company, and because we believe strongly in the concept of owning the plant and selling the gas, keep the cow, sell the milk. There was a lot of upfront capital, and we had no revenue coming in as we started separate companies, and you couldn't, you know, consolidate one against the other, so you couldn't match cash flows. Each one had a joint venture partner that we had developed. And Ed simultaneously had the view in the United States that we ought to begin to take our technology skills and apply them to the chemical industry. And so he started the chemical business. First the ammonia plant, and then the acquisition of Fujri, and then the acquisition of Escambia Chemical, and then Airco Chemicals, and so he's trying to push the chemical business forward, and he's got some good deals. And I'm over there in Europe trying to make acquisitions to accelerate our growth in the gas business, and we run out of money. And one I had a wonderful joint venture deal in Italy with the second largest company in the north of Italy, which would have put us in the ground floor in Italy, and I'd been selling oxygen plants in Italy from London and winning important orders there. Now what we want to do is become a gas company and not just a hardware company. So I have the deal all cut. It would take $1 million to fund it. plus $1 million to, you know, as working capital and so forth to expand it. And we had a handshake. I call Ed office, all excited. And they tell me they're going to have to build a big new chemical plant. And so I was pissed off, to be honest with you. But because I worked so hard in getting these deals. And I went back to them and said, look, we don't have any capital, but we'll put our technology in. You put the capital up, we'll put the technology in. Well, they were kind of insulted. And so that deal failed. Many, many years later, just almost 40 years later, I did do a deal in Italy where we did acquire a major thing, but this time we had to bring our own capital. And in the meantime, Union Carbide picked up this other company, and that's their company in Italy. And so,
when did the cartel start really paying attention to you?
Well, it took the British quite a while. I went through about 10 managing directors while I was there. They think the problem was their managing directors, not their marketing policies. You know, it's like competing with a public utility company. A monopoly just doesn't know how to compete, because they're so used to taking orders. I was on the phone this morning with AT&T, and the girls are very pleasant. And I'm telling them, look, I'm paying 20 cents a minute, and I think that's too much, and I'm doing all these calls to this one area. Don't you have a wide area network that, you know, well, you're on our lowest rate, and we don't have any other rates, and why don't you try the business department? So they give me a, can I transfer it? No, they're very pleasant, but they're not solving my problem, because I think I'm paying too much for all these calls going back to Pennsylvania. And the same thing with British Oxygen. You know, they had their rules and their regulations, and that's the way they do business. And the fact that Air Products would come in there and would put caps on the cylinders, would have a tailgate that didn't smash the concrete on the customer's deck when we put the cylinder down. I mean, just little things that were customer-focused, customer-oriented. And we had built that philosophy very early on. We were small, we were competing them with these large giants, and we knew that we just had to give better service. And we did, and so we won our share of new customers. But there is just tremendous opportunities when you're competing with monopoly to become customer focus and dig in and find out what customer needs are and respond to those needs and develop, you know, engineering alternatives and different technical solutions. And I think that, you know, those companies that do that really do grow for them. I mean, you know, clearly we have built today a $4.5 billion business, literally out of thin air. I mean, it's not just a catchy title. I mean, that's mm-hmm. what we did. Mm-hmm. We had no raw material position. We had no technology position going in. All we had was a group of entrepreneurial people with forward-looking ideas and a concept that if we could figure out ways of getting the price of the industrial gases down and focus on new markets, not just competing to serve existing customers where you had to battle to take them away, although we weren't opposed to doing that either, but offering, you know, cost advantages, we believe that we could make the market grow. And that's what happened. When we started out in the United States, we used to throw all the nitrogen away. Well, Air Products said, well, gee whiz, why do we want to do that? I mean, there's four times as much nitrogen as oxygen. Let's focus on markets for nitrogen, because carbide was so oriented to the metals industry and selling oxygen for processing steel that all the nitrogen. So we said, well, all right, let's go after that. So we looked at electronics and looked at food. We looked at blanketing, shielding, purging. Today we sell 3.5 times as much nitrogen as we do oxygen. Mm. Now stoichiometrically, 4 to 1, we need a little bit of it for internal processing. But the point is, if you focus on what we thought was the obvious, but others had just focused on one aspect, you can, and of course, as a result of that, our costs were lower because if we can take 4.5 parts of the gas we process and find markets for it, I can only take 1 out of 5 parts, well, we're going to have much lower unit costs. It's like selling all the chlorine and all the caustic and all the hydrogen out of a chlorine cell when somebody else can only sell the chlorine and has to give the caustic away. We did that.
As you were developing in Europe, the people you were hiring,
yeah,
the bright engineers,
yeah,
were they Americans or were they local?
Mostly locals. I don't think at any time we had more than maybe 10 Americans in residence there. And we just took the... First, they were expensive to send over. I had to provide housing and schooling and overseas compensation and all those things, none of which I got when I went, but that came later. What we really wanted to do was we wanted the brightest and best. And then language is a problem on the continent, so we wanted people that knew the culture, knew the language. And it took a while. We made some mistakes because if you don't know the language, you don't know the nuances, you don't always able to interpret what the person's saying and whether they really have what it takes. But the other thing that we concluded is that if we wanted to mold an organization to be really entrepreneurial, we really didn't want to hire people from our competitors, because then we would have to change all of the things that they had grown up to. I mean, it would be nice to have some of their knowledge about specific customers, but what we really wanted was an entrepreneurial organization who would work for long hours for low pay, and we couldn't afford big salaries either. But as a consequence, we think we really built the company around a lot of strong people. I mean, the vice president of engineering came out of Britain, the head of our sales for electronics came out of Britain. We have some of our top technologists from Germany and France today, and now we're bringing Oriental people in. And so by going for the brightest and the best and then teaching them what they have to know about our business turned out to be a much better strategy. Now, in a few key areas like finance, where we need good, solid experience, people who had a reputation and could breed confidence, controllers, tax people, lawyers, there you were buying experience, not just raw entrepreneurial spirit. And so we had a blend of that. But in the main, the managers that we hired at the beginning are the ones that are running the companies today. Ron Sullum, who runs all of Southern Europe for us, was a CDP graduate from Leeds University. Al Bull was a young sales engineer with a German chemical company. Dave Moran, we hired out of Imperial College. The guy that we just sent to Hong Kong, Jeff Proctor, came from CDP, from one of the Welsh universities. And you can go right through the whole organization, finance, engineering, marketing, and so forth. And it's a pattern that we did in the United States, too. Hire the brightest and the best, do it every year, good years and bad, build a cadre, build depth. Our competitors today are struggling. British Oxygen, had to hire somebody that was a top executive in Air Products to try to bail them out, because they just never had done their homework in building layer upon layer of bright, young, capable people who would then matriculate up to the top. People that wanted to start as a sales engineer to become chairman of the board. And you know, it's an obvious strategy today, you know, succession planning and development, but Air Products focused on it almost from the beginning, which is with all the other things you have to do, and it's amazing. We believed in diversified experience. Sending me to Europe at age 29 with a freshly minted MBA degree was a great thing for me, but it was a great thing for the company too, because I developed experiences and knowledge and diversified work practices that nobody else in the company had. And so I was able to add a dimension to the company, and of course international is now one of our major thrusts, as it is the major thrust of the chemical industry today.
I was going to ask if, well, I mean, first of all, those must have been pretty heady times for you, being that young and having all this opportunity and laying there in your for you to work with.
At the time, I didn't perceive it to be opportunity, but a whole bunch of problems. But
Did you have any interactions with your counterparts in other American companies who were also expanding in Europe at that
time? A few, yes, and that was helpful. I mean, it was a little easier to sell to DuPont or to Ford Motor or General Motors, because we had a bit of a reputation in the United States, so we weren't a total stranger, and I didn't have to, you know, with a British customer or a Belgian customer, you had to go back to, you know, have this kind of a dialogue as how you got here, and are you going to stay? I mean, if we sign a 15-year contract, are you going to be here 15 years from now? Because, you know, they looked around at us, and versus the safe decision would be to go with a solid, true blue guy. But, you know, and we didn't win every order, and there were those that were more nationalistic inclined, or those that were somewhat risk averse. We did make a point that that they had a stake in fostering competition, and that they weren't prepared to back us. Clearly, we would not be here in the long term, but if they were prepared to back us, we had a long-term future.
Hi.
So it went well, and you know, we grew on the continent, developed businesses in Belgium and the Netherlands, France. We did a lot of exporting to Spain, Germany, and we competed with our principal worldwide competitors in their home market, and that's an important thing to do, because if you want to test yourself against your toughest competition, compete with them at home. They're relatively weaker abroad, and so you're to beat up on them in the United States is not nearly as challenging, or do you have to be as good as competing with them in their own backyard, where they have much more strength and capability and relationships. And so if you can win there, you can win anywhere. You know, the song says, you know, if I can do it in New York, I can do it anywhere. Well, if you can do it in France, you can do it. Or do it in Tokyo, you can do it any place. And so that's what we did. And we strengthened ourselves, because we learned what it took to win at the highest level. We organized how to win at the highest level. We hired the right kind of people to succeed. And if you needed better, more creative, more technically competent, more entrepreneurial people to win, those same characteristics served you well. The other thing about being an international company is that every market, as we learn about the power thing, is not the same. But the experiences that you gain in one market are translatable. And so it strengthens a company to participate in many markets around the world, and then flow those experiences back and then distribute them back out to your network. And the companies that are in the world marketplaces competing to different degrees of applications, different uses of products, different end market requirements, they develop that knowledge and then they can introduce it around the world. And so those companies that only focus on the United States, I think, suffer because it's a big world out there with a lot of things going on, and if you're not interacting with those things, you're going to get left behind. That is the lesson of the American steel industry. They never went abroad. And so they never knew what was happening in Japan and in Europe and in Australia, Austria. And those technology developments driven by different sets of economics that existed then in those markets, but ultimately existed in the United States, were driving technological changes that just eroded. I mean, we were putting in open hearth furnaces when Europe was building LD steel plants. And, it was taking 5 hours to do a heat that they were doing in 30 minutes. But we weren't interacting. We weren't competing. We weren't there. We weren't on the ground floor. The United States was rather smart to get Wernher von Braun's scientists to come over here because we didn't know about that rocketry that was going on. And that was one of the things that I was able to do, is to change the horizon, the breadth of the company, and create a cadre of people with different education, different cultural experiences, and then to help to blend that into our American experience. And of course, in the process of doing that, I think we became a stronger company with better visions. And Union Carbide never did do it until real late. And then, of course, we were introducing new products and technologies that in the United States market they knew nothing about. And then they started to scramble to try to play catch up, but they lost the momentum. And
you came back from Europe
in
67.
Yeah, we were there 10 years. Yeah.
When you came back, did you feel you had accomplished your one page list you wrote down?
Not really. We hadn't gotten the full market share, but we certainly had put in place the things we needed. We put the people, the plants, we were on the continent, and we were the only company who was operating in all of those different markets. And so it's been said that the American companies did a better job of taking advantage of the common market of Europe than the Europeans did, because we went across those borders because we didn't have those cultural barriers that existed. And because we were a stranger wherever we went. So, you know, being a stranger in Paris was no different than being a stranger in Germany. We just had to do the things. Whereas it was difficult for the French to think in terms of competing in Britain or competing in Germany. I mean, they just didn't do those things. Whereas, the Americans said, well... And so we would build plants on the border of Belgium and send one pipeline into Holland and one into Belgium. We'd build a plant on the border of France and send it into Germany. And, you know, the borders didn't mean anything to us. And the distances were so much shorter than the distance in the United States that geography wasn't a barrier to, you know, thinking in global terms. Now, I presume there were some people that, you know, thought on a countrywide basis, but we did. We looked at the whole market and tried to build plants that were as large as possible and thereby as low cost as possible to serve the largest market that could be, you know, economically served from a single point.
Why did you come back? What
Well, I had felt that I had accomplished primarily the goals I wanted to do. Ed Donnelly was moving up in the organization as president, and I thought that now was the right time to get in there and become the executive vice president.
Which was a new position, wasn't it?
Well, I think Ed had enjoyed that position too.
But relatively new.
Yeah. And it was an opportunity to run... all of our gas businesses worldwide. Yeah, I was probably the first one to run all gas business because I would, alternatively, one week I would report to Ed, another week report to Leonard, and then to George, and depending upon what was hot at home. And so I came back and really turned Europe over to a British successor. And then we had some problems in Germany. Had to go back and fix those and get new management in place. And then in the United States, we started to focus on a more market-oriented type approach, by products and markets. And we created a medical division, and we created an international division. We created a...
and there a welding division?
Yeah,
that you
welding
started?
And medical, yeah. And ultimately, we made some initiatives, but we really never was able to get to a critical mass. And it was partly done as a diversification effort, and the core businesses continued to grow so rapidly that we really didn't succeed very well in those things, and ultimately merged them back in. But we continued to push on the international growth. We went to Canada, went to Mexico, started the Far East, went to Japan, and through a whole series of joint venture acquisitions throughout the Pacific. And so today we're probably in 30 different countries around the world. And so I was able to take the experiences in Europe, and the there's always a, you know, a fear about going, well, how are you ever going to, you know, penetrate Canada? I mean, they got a big, well, look, we did it in Britain, we did it in Germany. I mean, Canada's on our doorstep. It's a lot easier. You fly people up and down. And then you start looking at the geography, and Toronto was closer than Washington. You know, people just didn't think in those terms. And 81 just went right from Allentown to Montreal. So
it's like you were talking about in Europe.
Yeah.
The European countries.
Oh, yeah.
They're at it.
Everything's an hour away. Yeah. But it just seems spread out and diversified and so forth. So I did that, and then ran all of our gas businesses. And then Ed was selected to succeed Leonard, and I followed Ed as president, and I picked up the chemical business, and then decided. Then we had an engineering and construction business, and there was this major thrust into the synfuels area, and we didn't feel we had enough engineering capability, and Ed made the decision to acquire an expanded capability in Stearns Roger, and we did that, and then that greatly increased our engineering capability, and we went after some of these major synfuel contracts with the government. We had a good concept of looking to the government as a means of developing emerging new technologies for government use, but technology that had a large potential commercial market application. That had been the story about oxygen plants, that had been the story about our helium recovery program, it was a story about liquid hydrogen, the space program, had been our involvement in providing liquid oxygen to the intermediate range rockets when we were confronting Russia with the Minuteman program. And so in every case, those projects and programs that we had built for the federal government served us very well in strengthening our relationships in going after key commercial markets. Carbide took a different tack. They didn't like dealing with governments. They were a burden. They were regulatory. They were administrative difficult. But we said, look, here's a way to get your research funded and your engineering, get experience, and build manufacturing capabilities. And yeah, we'll put up with all those burdensome mechanistic dealings in order to expand our markets and to develop our technologies. And so we just took advantage of the needs of the government, provided those needs could be demonstrated to have potential application to the commercial market, and then we could be the instrument for taking that technology into the marketplace. And So we've been a good example of the benefits of just like, you know, Boeing developed the jetliner out of their tanker program for the government. So we developed the liquid hydrogen business, which is where we dominate that market today, because of our involvement in the space program.
I'm not sure how much more time you have available.
Well, what are some of the key questions that you want to make sure you get answered here?
There was one thing in particular. 1986, Donnelly turned the company over to you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you set out on your 10-year plan.
Plan, right. Mm-hmm.
The one aspect of that I wanted to sort of focus on here comes from this committee on innovation.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm quite intrigued, and that's one of the things we're trying to do is look at innovation in mm-hmm. chemical industry.
Yeah, right.
First of all, what does innovation mean to you and your experience with it?
Well, I guess I've developed my thinking about that. I have a view that wealth is created through the introduction of new products, processes, and technologies which lower costs, reduce the consumption of materials, improve the benefit to the customers. And that as engineers, manufacturers particularly, that we are the wealth creators of the country. It's only through innovation that wealth is created. I mean, the steam engine to replace the horse-drawn, the 747 that replaces the 707, the PC that replaces the big blue box, the cellular telephone, the satellite, every innovation that expands markets, reduces costs, makes things cheaper, uses less materials, less energy, that increases wealth. And then the role of the manufacturer is to divide up, if you will, the benefits of that innovation between the consumer and the producer. And so my view is that innovation and creativity and technological advances are the fundamental driving forces that create economic well-being for society. And that those societies that focus on those things broadly are the ones that progress and develop. Those companies that do it, those divisions within companies. And I think if you look that through, you'll find that is a truism, that the wealth of nations is no longer a function of raw materials or of access or natural resources. It's a function of their ability to innovate, to take advantage of those things, but raw materials, minerals are readily available to everybody. And it was particularly important to Air Products because we started with no advantages, just air, and everybody had access to air. Innovation was the absolute driving force. Now, you could have innovation in financing techniques, which we did. We developed some very unique on-site financing techniques where we built plants using the customer's credit and the contract that he guaranteed to buy from us. You can have innovation in marketing and in creating new uses and applications. We freeze all the McDonald's hamburgers. We put the space shuttle up and so forth. You can have innovation in technology. We created processes for liquefying helium and hydrogen and LNG and taking oxygen out of air by absorption rather than by cryogenics, water solvent-based chemicals. And so, but if you can do all of those things and do them simultaneously, innovation in marketing and manufacturing, you know, we now have 100% of the world's market for LNG because we have the world's finest manufacturing systems for building these huge 200-ton heat exchangers, which we then ship all over the world to be the core process for liquefying natural gas. And so that has been our driving force, and we have created wealth. We have created wealth for the nations in which we have operated because we've lowered their costs and improved their economic output. We have created wealth for the companies we serve. We supply customers all over the world. We have lowered their costs by introducing oxygen. And, of course, we have created wealth for the shareholders of Air Products and the employees of Air Products and the communities in which we serve. And so it's a bit of philosophy, but it really is a truism that that innovation is the thing that... And you go back to Schumpeter economics. Capitalism is the... is the replacement of the old with the new. And out of that process of replacing the old way with the new way, you create wealth. And that's what we think we do. We find better ways of processing air at lower costs, providing more benefits to our customers at lower costs, improving the quality of their products, the productivity of their operations, flat glass today is made in an atmosphere of hydrogen and nitrogen. There isn't an industrial process that doesn't use industrial gases and use them in an expanding way. And the same is true when you substitute water-based solvents for water-based emulsions for solvent-based emulsions. You improve the quality of the environment. You keep the ozone from dissipating. And the reason the American chemical industry, as an industry, has been more successful than almost any other industry, with the exception of maybe electronics, is the high rate of innovation that takes place. High percentage of our sales is spent on research and development. The steel industry has not been an innovative, not been as innovative as the aluminum industry. And so that drive to cannibalize the existing processes with new ones, which lower costs and improve benefits, is this thing that has made the chemical industry, electronic industry, and has made America the country it is. We started out with advantages in raw materials and agriculture and so forth, but today we rely on the entrepreneurial and innovation capability of our people, and so that's why education, that's why opportunities, why delegation of responsibility to people, and optimizing the performance of individuals as creators and innovators. That's why that is so important, because if you get that right, everything else takes care of itself.
It's pretty obvious from what I've read that you were very people-oriented, employee-oriented. You really were trying to encourage innovation and entrepreneurship, right, just as you had that freedom to do that in Europe.
Yeah, right.
How do you go about doing that? You're a bigger company now. Things are more complex than they were when you were doing
it. Well, I think that I think you really want to divide things up into pieces where people can see the whole. And so you take businesses and break them up into product lines or geographic markets or market applications or industries, so that people can see the whole parameter of how your product fits in with a group of customer needs, and then organize in serving customers. You know, we exist in business for one reason only: to serve customers. And so how well we do that, how well we understand our customers' needs and what their real needs are, not always what they say they are, because sometimes they're different than and to get as close to the customer so that you can understand those and then drive your processes to be responsive to those changes. We got very close to the electronic industry through some of our nitrogen applications, and we built pipelines to serve. And the Silicon Valley today is totally connected to Air Products, and we to them. They couldn't function if one of our plants shut down. I mean, you don't have to have an earthquake. Just cut our pipeline, and you'd put the electronics industry out of business. And but we sensed the need for this ultra-high purity, that the microprocessors of the future were going to be submicron line widths, and the purity of the gases had to be so high that you couldn't have dust particles or oxygen impurities which would interfere with a submicron line width, 1/400th of the width of the hair. And that are etched on these silicon chips to get 64 million pieces on the thumbnail of a chip the size of your thumbnail. And so we started working on with customers to perfect the purity of our products, and now we're the world leaders. The customers became so dependent upon us that they invite us to come in and set up shop in their factory and control the processes that lead up to their diffusion furnaces, where they actually do the etching and on their silicon chips. So we have formed partnerships with our customers. But I think that you start with an understanding that it's important. Because the good Lord only gave us so many atmospheric gases. So the challenge that we have to then work on is how can we be innovative in taking those gases to more productive end uses? How can we process them at lower cost? How can we serve our customers more cost effectively, building plants right next door, becoming part of their team? How can we develop application machinery that facilitates the use of our products in our customers' factories? And so you encourage people, and they quickly recognize that, you know, if we only have a limited things to work with, then we've got to be very good at the end use and application and processing techniques. And
do you have a reward system?
Very much so, yeah, in many forms. And you know, in the early days, the rewards were promotion, if you will. But today, you know, you're eliminating layers, so there aren't quite so many promotions. So personal recognition is the most important reward. To be recognized by one peers is that you've done a good job. Now, we used to, you know, to give people promotions, but you can't always promote people. But to recognize amongst their peers, amongst their families, and so forth, you can put monetary rewards on that, and we do. We have many events where we recognize the best driver of the year, the best safety of the year, the best marketing man, the best manufacturing team. Increasingly, we're recognizing not one person but teams, because we recognize that many of the problems and challenges cannot be solved by one person, but a group of people working together as an effective team. So there are team awards for quality, for productivity. We reward suppliers for their unique performance, and we make them feel part of our team, and through us, the customer's team. And we're not competing with each other. The old, what was it, illegitimate non-carborundum, ride the bastard down, you know, that really doesn't work, because you're not motivating them to excel if all you're doing is pounding on their price. You want to help them find ways to be more cost competitive, but that may mean changing your specifications and changing their manufacturing processes so that they can. And if Motorola wins by selling more telephones, we win by selling more gas to make chips that goes in those phones. And so the recognition that there's no way that you can win if your customer doesn't win is a way of looking at it. And getting that through, you just have to spend a lot more time in communicating where you're going, what the challenges are, what the customer needs are, surveying customers, how are we doing all the time.
Yeah, I'll get it, Donnie.
So, and you have to operate it at all levels. You have to operate at the technological discovery level, and a group of scientists are looking for new technologies and new ways. You have to operate at the engineering application area. You have to work at the customer applied R&D area. And you have to have good communications across those lines, so that even the people working in the laboratory on discovering new physical properties and new physics, chemistry, and biology, that they are knowledgeable about how that discovery could potentially impact on end market requirements. You really have to be market focused, although sometimes you don't know what potential markets are until you discover, you know, the phenomena. Mm-hmm. You know, where could a new polymer go? And then you have to take it and go out and try it and see if it has a fit someplace. So you have to operate on those, but you have to make a commitment to it, and you have to be patient. You have to sometimes protect R&D programs for which there are no immediate market applications, but where you potentially believe that work in that area, catalysis. We've done a lot of work in hollow fibers in recent times because they're good membrane systems and can effectively separate gases. We're constantly looking at new emulsion systems, particularly systems that will work in a water-based environment rather than a solvent-based system.
You've just made a very interesting comment about protecting areas for a period of time because there's no immediate output, and it seems. Well, let me ask you, what do you think? But it seems that today that's not done very much anymore.
There's a lot of pressure on performance. I think we're getting better, though. I really do. I mean, I think that maybe we have spent a lot of money, maybe not wisely, maybe not cost effectively in the past, and so we're becoming a little bit more market-oriented and focused. But if you say, look, 20% of R&D ought to be on discovery, and 50% ought to be on process, and 50% on products or applications or something, and you can do that. The problem that you have is that many times R&D is a long-term process. But the managers in charge of running a business are going to be there 5 years, and they're going to get diversified experience doing something else. And so clearly there is a trade-off between what the business manager running a business for 5 years is looking at and what an R&D guy may take 10 years to from concept to application is looking at. And so but I think the good business leaders recognize that R&D is a process that's long in duration. The companies that have succeeded the best are those who have been most innovative, have introduced the most new products. Every product has a life cycle. It will ultimately disappear. If it doesn't disappear physically, it'll disappear economically, that you just can't compete anymore. And so that you have to constantly renew your portfolio with the constant introduction of new products, new markets, new technologies, and if that is understood as one of the driving forces to success, then you just do it. We like to say that investment really for the future consists of two things, and it consists of hardware and technology. And we have to be investing in proper proportion of both things. If you just put a lot of money into hardware that processes things the same way or the same products, pretty soon you're going to have a lot of new hardware, but it's going to be dedicated to old products. That's the story of the open heart furnace when somebody else was putting LD furnaces in. So you've got to make sure that you've got a proper balance. The problem that we have is an accounting problem. The accounting systems require us to write off technology against current income today, because we cannot say with certainty what the value of that technology is over time. But hardware, which is equally uncertain, but because it's physical plant, we can amortize over 10 or 15 years. And so the charge for that investment is only 1/15th per year, whereas the charge for the technology investment is 100%. I mean, it's just an accounting mechanism. And we kid ourselves. So, but when you begin to think about your investing in technology and hardware as a combined process and making sure your rate of investment and the balance between hardware and software is right, then it's all right. Air Products today has the highest ratio of total investment, R&D and hardware, of any company in the chemical industry. We will be investing this year more than 30% of our current level of sales in R&D and technology.
It's very high.
But if you do that and do it successfully, you are creating a huge pump, because you're priming the pump, and the cash flows that will flow from that increasingly will just give you the means to do it. I mean, we're spending over $1 billion this year in new plant and equipment, and this is a company with $4 billion in sales. And then we're putting another $100 million on top of that for R&D.
This means then you have to be willing to take risks.
Yes, but not foolish risk, measured risk. And we try very hard to measure those things. But there's nothing that's certain. And when you're making a capital investment and you do a DCF analysis back to present worth on something's going out 15 years, the calculations are precise, but boy, the database is very imprecise. I mean, you're just making judgments about the future, and I think that's also why that some technological vision is needed to give you a sense about if there's a fallacy, I think, in business, that we probably don't spend enough time trying to synthesize the futures. Many times the facts are there, but we don't know how to weight them as to the probability. I mean, what will be the impact of digital communication? What will be the impact on the next series of microprocessors? I mean, IBM got, as smart as they are, got missed the trajectory curve of microprocessors, and those big blue boxes were replaced by a whole bunch of PCs. Now the big boxes are coming back; they're sold out today. But you know, for they were broadside. The American steel industry, as I said, got broadside by the American automobile industry. Got broadside by the small, efficient automobile from Japan. And so you have to constantly try to project forward the evolutionary innovative forces that are changing the world the way we live in.
Which is what you tried to do in 86 with your 10-year plan.
Yeah.
You said, I read somewhere that you said
and,
it was a...
And to make a commitment to have a group of people studying technologies, trying to, you know, push the frontiers forward. And you don't always get it right. You miss some things. You've got to also be very, very sensitive to the NIH factor. Everybody is comfortable with what they know, and they're uncomfortable with what they don't know. And what they don't know is what, you know, kills you. I mean, the steel industry was the example of that. I mean, that's. But I think people who are in the technology creation business are at least somewhat more sensitive to the fact that technology can have a major impact upon your business, and you better be on top of the technological forces that are happening. But I mean, it doesn't have to be technology. I mean, well, it's application technology. Look at the airline systems and their reservation systems. I mean, American Airlines makes more money on reservations than they do on carting people. So having an information-based system is tremendous. Merrill Lynch people grabbed a huge lion's share of the investing market by offering this computerized-based customer management account system that gave their customers in one sheet of paper every month a precise balance sheet of all of the securities they're interested in. So they had, and they just did it by computerizing their information and flows. And so there are ways from a commercial standpoint. Air Products has introduced barcoding on cylinders, and so we can tell every customer precisely where each cylinder is. Walmart in their cash register system ties back to their suppliers, so suppliers knows overnight what the stock balance is every Walmart store. DuPont has cut the cycle time for replacement of fashions. Used to, you know, you'd order the fashions in the fall for the spring for the fall. They've gone through that and they've optimized it, and today they can measure the consumptions of the limited stores' current fashions, the amount of cloth that takes. They can change their mills. They can ship the material to China, have the Chinese process it overnight, put it on Federal Express, and deliver it to those stores to the size, color, fashion they want. And they can do that in 14 days. And it used to take 6 months. Mm-hmm. Well, the people that can innovate in terms of response to customer needs can capture huge. Chrysler, last winter in the Northeast, were able to change their manufacturing processes so that they could get more of their four-wheel vehicle drives out into the marketplace. And they captured billions of dollars of market share. And look at their earnings this year. I mean, but they were made their systems agile to change in customers' needs, and they were able to get that production line organized and all their suppliers, 50,000 suppliers that, you know, participate to change what they were doing, input, get those cars out and get those trucks out, and they captured market share. And 15 snowstorms in the Northeast changed their relative market share position to that of General Motors just because they were able to organize themselves to respond to those. And that's innovation but innovation in agile manufacturing capability.
Okay. I know your time is limited. Are you?
Yeah. Are there anything else? We've got about 10 minutes here.
Okay, let me go to my other sheet because I did want to.
There were a couple of things that you talked about the industry in general on there.
One is, what is important for the future of chemical innovation? We've been.
Well, I think that if I took the industry as a whole and how we. I think the thing that is important and has changed in my lifetime is one. I think we are certainly much more people focused than we have been in the past, and that everybody is knowledgeable about what the industry is trying to do, what customers are trying to do, and so forth. We certainly have taken a strong responsibility since Bhopal for the environment. We're not resisting government. We're trying to be a leader in anticipating what is the right thing to do and organize and then measure our performance, publicize our performance. Every chemical company will be sending a report out this year on what they're doing, showing the progress over the last 5 years, showing what remains to be done. We're running television ads. We have come to recognize that we exist at the behest of the public, and we better be responsive to the public's concerns just as we're responsive to customers' needs and then organize to do that. And it's not going to help us to say, well, we're misinterpreted, they don't understand us. It's our obligation to make sure that they do understand us and understand the risk and what we're doing and how we're taking care of them and that we are responsible for their well-being, our neighbors, our customers, our users, and that we're going to see that our products are disposed of properly, that our commitment to the environment is just as great as the commitment to the environment in your own backyard is. The other thing is that we are a worldwide industry. That two-thirds of the market for chemical products lies outside the United States, and we have to access and be a party and serve those customers there. And there are a lot of bright people that live outside the United States, and we want to access them and so forth. That the creation of wealth and economic progress for nations and for companies and for individuals is tied in to our ability to create new products that serve the markets more economically, more advantageously, more efficiently, with lower consumptions of energy and materials, and we have to drive our businesses and invest there. We must invest for the long term, that you cannot optimize your business on three-year cycles. You're making chemical investments for 15 years, you're making technology bets for 15 years, you're not going to be right on every one. You got to have lots of horses in a race. Some will win, some will fail, some will break even, and so you've got to have lots of bets out there. I think the chemical industry is in relatively good shape on these philosophies, but I think they're the things that have kind of come together: people, products, and processes, markets, and that we have a collective accountability to all of those stakeholders, to the communities in which we operate, to the employees in the companies, to the shareholders who invest, to the customers, and to the nation as a whole. And it's balancing those forces and doing it in a responsible way that will cause, I think, the American chemical industry to become and continue to be one of the great industries in the world. I think we've got it right, and I think that the the attitudes amongst the leaders of the chemical industry is that we do have a collective accountability. We don't want to have happen to us what happened to the nuclear industry, mm-hmm. where they did not do a good job of communicating the risk benefits and the enormous investments they were making in safety. And that industry lost its constituency, and they're out of business. And it could happen if we did not adequately share that sense of responsibility to the publics we're in. But you know, we're over that. Bhopal was a lesson, and you can point fingers to somebody else, but we are the stewards of a healthy environment, and it's the burden, you know, lies on us. Mm-hmm. And we're finding that it's not a zero-sum cost, that by being better stewards, we can find more efficient ways of doing things. It always is. And that some of the paragons of cost are really not so bad, that we can put in environmental systems that save money. Air Products is making good business out of its environmental systems business, where we take trash and recycle it and create electricity out of it, where we take sulfur out of the air and make gypsum for wall boards, for housing. And so there's an infinite number of positive sides by being good stewards and being concerned about the environment. It's not just being goody-goody, it's good business as well. And then I think our people feel better about it. People are not asked to make a trade-off between safety and environment and bottom line and customer service. That you got to do all of those things. To hit a home run, you got to touch all the bases. You just can't touch first base and third. You got to do them all. And we're doing that. I think we're doing it in our own company, but I think I see the industry doing that, and so I'm very proud of the. I think the response, and I've seen a real step change in attitude from absolute resistance. The government doesn't understand us, and they don't know us, to a recognition that we have a responsibility to communicate what we're doing, how we're doing it, and if the customer doesn't understand it, it's not his fault, it's our fault. We haven't done a good enough job of communicating to that customer. And so that's
now, after Silent Spring, the industry stonewalled for some time.
Exactly. And I was in some of those meetings. And Air Products never really had the problem because we're pristine. We take air and clean it up and make it better than it was. So, but And honestly, we didn't have the database. We did not know the impact that chemicals were having on an environment, on human health. We were the VCM problem and the melanoma cancers, the effect of lung smoking. These were things 40 years ago we had not. Some companies had done some, epidemiology studies that had shown correlations, but nothing, you didn't know that he hadn't isolated to a few substances. But that's yesterday. We're running with the ball. DuPont shut down their Freon operation. They finally agreed that there was a direct correlation between ozone dissipation and the emission of freons to the atmosphere. Air Products has got a whole bunch of new water-based systems for blowing foams that don't require freons anymore. We use liquid nitrogen for freezing food, and you don't have to use freons. It's a little more expensive, but we're driving that cost down too. So, once the facts are sought out, and once they are studied, there are a lot of things you can do to be responsive to the genuine concerns. The problem the environmentalists had is they weren't scientists; they worked on emotion, but they had a good sense too. I mean, I think that we all recognize today that we live in a small blue dot in the cosmos, and that we have a collective responsibility to keep that blue dot, you know, shining as a bright light on the hillside. And
I think on that note, then I will close, and I thank you very much for spending this time with me this morning.
Pleasure. I think what you're doing is good work. I think the chemical industry has a good story to tell today. It does not have anything to be embarrassed about. It's progressive. It's forward-looking. It's creating wealth for the world, really, because through the products in medicine and polymers and environmental systems, we're making a difference. And I'm proud to, you know, have been a part of that process.
Okay, well, thank you again very much.
Jim, well, thanks for coming and seeing us. Where are you going from here? And